want your soul.
You won't find anything about it on the news or the internet. The case was declared closed soon after the crash, claiming there were no survivors. I never told anybody about it, not even my late wife. I guess the whole thing traumatized me so much that I just wanted to push it to the back of my mind and never think about it again. But it was always there, gnawing at me, reminding me. So now, I'm going to tell you about it. It was early fall and I had boarded the plane which would take me home for my 2-week-long business trip. The plane took off just fine, and since I'm so prone to jet lag, I decided to get a little bit of sleep. I'm not sure how much time had gone by, but I remember strong turbulence waking me up. I opened my eyes in horror, to see luggage falling down around and passengers screaming. "What's going on?" I instantly became alert, asking the terrified lady next to me. She outright ignored me, clutching her seat feverishly. Oxygen masks dropped from above, and I put mine on as soon as it did, buckling my seatbelt with trembling hands. I looked outside the window and saw the tops of endless rows of trees dangerously close and getting closer by the second. "This is it," I thought. "It's all over." Those were my last thoughts before impact, and everything then went dark. I awoke on the floor of the airplane. Luggage, spilled food, and other items were all around me. I looked up towards the pilot's cabin and was met with a view of trees. The plane had apparently broken into pieces, but the fuselage seemed somewhat intact, despite the mess around me. My first thought was, I survived. Thank God. I looked down at my aching body and tried to assess the damage. I was pretty bruised up and my shoulder had a minor cut, but other than that, nothing serious. It was then that I heard the voices of other passengers around me. To my left, it sounded like a woman was crying and another woman was consoling her. In front of me, I heard a moaning sound, while to my right was a man who seemed to be bruised up like me, but he was fine. I got up and realized that a handful of us were still alive and some were already checking the dead bodies for their vital signs. "We need to help the injured now," one of the survivors shouted. I joined in to help them with that, checking the pulses of the passengers that weren't messed up so badly that they could potentially be alive. "Linda, she's gone. I'm sorry," the consoling woman told the young girl who was sobbing over what we later figured was her sister's dismembered body. A few minutes later, we saw a passenger who was alive in a seat, but just barely. He had a metal pipe hanging from his gut and his legs were crushed beyond recognition. He begged us to kill him, and after some hesitation, Mitch, one of the survivors, picked up a bar and hit him in the head with it till he was dead. The rest of us turned away while it happened, as we couldn't barely hear the listening to the sound of the bar connecting to the man's skull, let alone watch it. "What should we do?" Linda asked. "Well, basic rules say that we should stay put and rescue will have an easier time finding us," I said. "He's right," another survivor said. "We need to set up an SOS signal and try to contact someone. Amber, are you getting anything?" He asked the woman who was consoling Linda earlier. She was on her phone trying to see if she could get a signal. "Nothing," she shook her head in desperation. "Not a single bar." "Then we have no choice but to wait," another survivor responded. "We have to set up a shelter. It's going to get cold tonight," I said. "Wait a minute, are we going to be here for that long?" Mitch asked. "Tonight, maybe a few more nights. We have to ration our food and get cozy." "Well, what about the ones who died? We have to give them a burial." "We will, sweetie," Amber spoke up. "But right now we have to think about our own survival." We went outside of the fuselage to see where we were, but despite having a small clearing, all around us were tall trees blocking our view. A few broken trees lay around, as a result of the plane knocking them down upon impact. Since there were no major elevations nearby, there was no way of telling how close or how far we were from civilization. We carried out the dead bodies and lined them up in front of the fuselage. We decided not to use our strength for digging, since who knows how long we'd have to stay here, so instead we just covered them with sheets and clothes. In total, there were only 6 of us left alive. Linda, Amber, Mitch, Will, Norton, and myself. At around dusk, it started to get really cold, so we used the luggage to block the opening in the fuselage as much as we could. Mitch used rocks to form an SOS sign in the small clearing behind the plane, in hopes to get the rescuers' attention faster. When night fell, we still couldn't get rid of the impending cold, so we put on extra clothes and huddled up on makeshift beds made from clothes and blankets of other passengers. We ate a meager meal of a candy bar per person and decided to get some sleep. Most of the group members fell asleep quickly, with the exception of Linda crying herself to sleep. I was the last one to finally doze off. I'm not sure what time it was when I suddenly woke up at the sound of a twig snapping outside the plane. I thought maybe someone had found us, so I shot up and peered out the window. I couldn't see anything, though, so I approached the luggage barricade and peered through the hole. I was met with pitch-black darkness outside our plane. I had never been camping before, so to see the woods in such absolute blackness terrified me. Thinking the sound may have been from an animal, I was about to return to bed when I heard another snap of a twig close by. This time I grabbed a flashlight and moved some of the luggage away, enough to make an opening for myself. I went outside and scanned the area with a beam of light. "Hello," I called out, hoping against hope that someone human would hear me, but no one was there. I went around the plane with every twig I stepped on echoing throughout the woods. It was then that I realized how quiet it actually was. When I went to bed, the forest was brimming with the sounds of its inhabitants. But now, there wasn't a single sound. No birds, no insects, no nothing. I remembered that when a forest goes quiet, it usually means that there is a predator nearby. My heart started racing, and I carefully scanned the area with my flashlight again and proceeded to back away towards the plane. I got to the barricade of luggage, and as I was about to climb, I heard another sound behind me. It sounded like something was slowly being dragged across the ground. I pointed my flashlight towards the source of the sound, to the pile of dead bodies. Slowly, I moved the beam from right to left across the still corpses covered by clothes. My flashlight finally reached the edge of the body line on the left, and my heart started thumping even faster. One of the jackets had been moved aside, and the space where a body had once been, between two other bodies, was now gone. The dragging sound resounded again. I moved the flashlight up and saw the body of a woman lying on the floor, and then it limply slid further into darkness by a few inches with that same dragging sound, leaving only her legs hanging in the light. I pointed the flashlight further upwards and saw the woman's wide eyes staring blankly towards the sky with an expressionless face. But that's not what scared me. Clasping the woman's hair, just at the edge of the light was a skinny, yet muscular, black and hairy hand. Two glowing eyes reflected back from the flashlight, and as soon as the creature saw me, it produced a very short scream, and then ran off with the sound of loud and impossibly quick footsteps echoing and at the same time fading almost instantly, dragging the woman behind itself into the darkness. I dropped the flashlight and ran back to the plane. I blocked the opening with the luggage, panting. I returned to my seat, surprised that no one was awake by my loud footsteps and breathing. I covered myself, keeping an eye on the luggage barricade. All night I thought I imagined skinny hands poking their way in, but whenever I blinked, they were gone. Sometime before dawn, I finally fell asleep. I awoke to the chirping of the birds and the voices outside. I sighed in relief, the nightmare still freshly imprinted in my mind. I then went outside and saw Norton and Will standing near the pile of bodies and having a heated discussion. I approached them to ask what they were talking about, and Norton quickly replied, "One of the dead passengers is missing. It might have been a bear." I looked past them towards the corpses and saw the space where one of the bodies should have been, and beyond that, distinctive tracks of something heavy being dragged on the ground stretched and disappeared into the tree line ahead. I knew what I saw the first night outside the plane wreck made no logical sense. So I went along with Will and Norton's theory that it was a bear that dragged the body away, opting not to tell them that I saw anything suspicious. I assumed that I was in shock from the plane crash and saw something that shouldn't have been there. None of it made sense to me. On day two, when everyone woke up, we gathered up in front of the plane and started making plans. We had enough food to last us for 3 days, at the most, if we rationed it, but we assumed we might be stuck longer than that. It was a long flight, and the area in which we were stuck was huge, so rescue was expected to be very slow. Amber tried getting a signal on her phone again before her battery died, but it wasn't happening. I told her to keep her phone off until we had a more elevated area. On that note, Mitch decided to gather wood, while Norton prepared traps for rabbits or any other animals we could find. Will's job was to move the bodies further away from the plane in order to prevent the bear from coming near us again. My job was to try and find a hill to climb or anything that would potentially lead us to our freedom. Mitch told me not to go too far away under any circumstances, and he gave me some lipstick to mark the trees, to not get lost. I put on a backpack and took a power bar and bottled water with me and started heading in one direction. I wanted to bring a knife, but the only thing we had was the hatchet, which we assumed came on the plane for breaking down doors in emergencies, and the others needed it for chopping wood. Besides, if a bear attacks you, we'll lose you and we'll lose the axe, Mitch said. Now remember, Norton explained as he escorted me out of the shelter. If you run into a bear, just play dead. He may toss you around, but as long as you don't move, you should be fine. But if it's a grizzly... I know, shout at him until he gets offended and runs away, I said. And assume a high power posture. You want him to feel threatened. Well, how do I know if it's a bear or a grizzly bear? I asked. Grizzlies have a hump on their shoulder, I think. You think? I raised my eyebrows. Look, as long as you go on shouting, the bear will know to avoid you. Well, how do you know that? Well, I watched it on that survival show with Bear Grylls. Oh, and don't run. Bears will see you as prey if you run, and then you're screwed. I went my own way while the others attended to their business. As I went on, I'd occasionally shout phrases like hey or hello to scare off any potential bears. I used the lipstick to mark the trees I passed with an axe every 10 or 20 steps or so. The terrain was uneven, and I almost twisted my ankle a few times, so by the time 1 hour had passed, I realized I probably hadn't gotten too far away from the camp. All the while, I ran into slopes here and there, but no major hills or anything, so I reckoned I'd have to climb one of the trees to get a good view of the area. I turned back and started to retrace my steps, since I figured I'd need some time to get back. The X which I had marked on the tree was visibly smudged now. Now, it could have been a squirrel or something, I know, but this was different. The smudge went down from the X in three even lines, as if someone had drawn their fingers across the tree bark. I held my breath as I checked out my surroundings, and I suddenly became aware of the stupid mistake I made once more. I didn't pay attention to the sounds, and the forest had gone silent during my walk when I wasn't listening. I suddenly felt like I was being watched. I didn't know if I should shout to chase the potential bear away or be quiet to avoid drawing attention, because something told me that what I was dealing with here was not a regular forest predator. I opted for the second option and silently proceeded back towards the camp, painfully aware of every leaf crunching under my feet. I kept looking over my shoulder every now and again, always afraid that I'd be met face-to-face with something incomprehensible. The further I went, though, the quieter it got around me. I felt like I was walking straight into the predator's arms. And then I heard something which made me stop. As I stepped on a crunching leaf, I heard a crunch 100 feet behind me. I wasn't sure if it was an echo or my imagination, but I shot around nonetheless and quickly scanned the area. Nothing was there. So then why did the hair on the back of my neck stand straight up and I feel such a primordial fear? I slowly scanned the trees again and stopped on one of them. Something was off about this one tree, and then my scream caught my throat when I realized what I was staring at was a black figure peeking from behind the tree. It wasn't moving and it was staring directly at me, with one hand held around the side of the tree. It stared at me as if I wasn't aware of it, and it was stalking me. I stared back at it in silence for a while, and it stared back at me, neither of us moving. I almost convinced myself that it was my imagination, like the way you see your pile of clothes on your chair in the middle of the night. But then its hand moved slightly down across the tree. I couldn't tell due to the distance, but one thing was for sure. That was no fucking bear. I turned around and started running, not caring about the rules Norton told me. I didn't care about the rules, the elevation. I just ran as fast as I could to find safety. After what felt like ages, I started hearing the voices of my fellow survivors in the distance, and the sounds of the forest came back to life. I soon saw the plain group ahead, gathered around a campfire. I ran to them and turned around to see if I was being followed, but nothing was there. You okay, Sam? Amber asked. I think there's something out there, I said, panting, not taking my eyes off the direction I just came from. Everyone was very confused, and when I explained to them what I saw just now and the night before, some of them became visibly worried. We agreed not to leave camp, and Mitch suggested to make a barricade around in order to prevent dangerous animals from wandering in. Each survivor was to carry something for defense. However, since everyone was short of weapons, except for Mitch, who claimed to have the axe for himself, the others got makeshift spears from wood. No one believed my description of the creature I saw. Hell, even I wasn't sure of what I saw. But they all agreed that it wasn't safe to go out there alone anymore. After lunch, we gathered up some more wood for the fire and tried to pass the time by talking to each other. Amber was a businesswoman who was on a trip just like me. She used to be married, but work came first for her. Linda was having the hardest time of us all, having witnessed her sister's death in the crash. The two of them were on a vacation when it all happened. She racked her mind about how her parents would react, but Amber comforted her most of the time. Mitch was an athlete who had a knee injury, so he was visiting his physiotherapist in the country. He considered himself lucky to even come out alive, let alone avoid more severe injuries in the crash. Will was a programmer, and that's all we managed to get out of him. And Norton was an assistant professor. Like Linda, he was also on vacation. It got dark and cold pretty soon, despite only being around 5 p.m., so we decided it was time to get back inside the airplane. Will insisted on staying outside and keeping the fire going, since it greatly improved our odds of being found. Although, I didn't feel happy about him staying out there alone. I knew he was right, and I sure as hell didn't want to stay out there either. At around 8 p.m., Mitch, Norton, and I joined him outside to keep him company. He had started building a makeshift fence by then, and big, sturdy branches were already sticking out of the ground in various places around the camp. "When I'm done here, this camp will be enough to last us through the entire winter," Will proudly said. "Well, let's hope we don't have to stay here for that long," I replied. Norton then went on to take a leak. "Think they'll find us soon?" Will asked. "I shouldn't be more than 10 days. This didn't seem to lift Will's spirits, though. Norton was done taking a leak, and he zipped his pants up. "Well, one thing's for sure," he said as he turned towards us. "At least we're spending some time away from technology." Will poked the burning wood while Mitch stared at the fire. The fire crackled violently for a moment, illuminating Norton's face and the area around him. In that split second, I saw something black and hairy behind him, slowly creeping up on all fours. Before it merged with the darkness again, I could tell it was the same creature from before. It was on all fours now and right behind Norton. I opened my mouth and tried to scream, but no sound came out. It all happened so fast. Norton's jovial expression turned into one of surprise as he got yanked backwards and his sudden screaming, mixed with the sound of dragging, faded only moments later, as if he somehow managed to run 100 yards in mere seconds. Everybody else instantly became alert. "Norton? Norton?" Mitch stood up. Norton's now barely audible screams faded completely, and the only sound remaining was the crackling of the fire. "Sam, what the fuck just happened?" Mitch shouted. It just took him," I barely uttered. "What took him?" Mitch asked. And then a scream came through which froze my bone to the marrow. It sounded like screeching tires which echoed throughout the woods and all the way to our camp. "Oh, we gotta get back inside now," I shouted. "No, we can't. We gotta help Norton. Mitch, think, if we go out there now, we're as good as dead. We gotta get back to the plane right now," I replied. All three of us ran back to the plane and barricaded it with the luggage. The two girls were confused and distressed, asking where Norton was and what that inhuman scream was, but we had no time to explain. "Listen, we need to be as quiet as possible. We don't know what's going on, but some fucking dangerous animals out there." We sat there together for what felt like hours, long after the flame had died down. Everyone was slumped down in the plane seats, clutching their spears. I started to get sleepy when a noise came from outside the plane. The snap of a twig. "Shh," Mitch said, lying across the seats with the hatchet held tightly to his chest. A sound of scratching came from my side of the plane, and I froze in place. A moment later, it stopped. I heard something that sounded like sniffing, followed by the sound of footsteps upon leaves, which then faded away. I gathered the courage to lift my head just enough to peek through the window. At first I saw nothing, and then through the darkness I saw movement. A tall, hunched-over figure was standing where the bodies had been moved. It bent down to inspect them before grabbing one with its abnormally long arm and dragging it away into the darkness, just like it did the woman the night before. I got no sleep that night again until sunrise. On the early morning of day 3, the chirping of the birds returned. That's how we knew that it was safe to go back outside. Despite that, we were still extremely paranoid when going out, and so we carefully observed the surroundings first. "Okay, I think it's gone," Mitch shouted to the rest of us. We followed him outside. Mitch turned to me with heavy bags under his eyes and asked, "Sam, what was that thing?" "I don't know. I saw it a few times by now, but I never managed to get a really good look at it." I shook my head. "Will, did you see it?" Mitch asked. "I didn't even see what happened to Norton at all until I heard the screams," Will said. We all stood in silence for a while. "We can't stay here anymore," Linda said. Okay, well, where are we going to go? We can't go wandering around in the woods with that thing stalking us here. We'll be sitting ducks. So what then? Amber interjected. I looked around and thought for a moment. I knew what the right thing to do was, but I hated the idea every bit anyways. We need to rescue Norton, I finally said. We can't leave him behind. Whoa, now. Mitch raised his hands. I didn't see it very well, but that creature looked pretty fucking dangerous to me. I'm not trying to go against it. Not to mention how fast it is. Norton's screams were one moment and then gone, Will said. I think we're going to be safe if we bring torches. That creature, whatever it is, stalked me from afar yesterday morning and was in our camp the night before. But it never approached me while there was a fire, and when I pointed my flashlight at it, it scurried away with the body of the passenger. It's a long shot, but it's worth a try. Okay, but how the hell do we find Norton? He could be anywhere out there. For all we know, he could even be dead. I pointed to the pile of bodies and said, last night it dragged another body away. It was always dragging them in the same direction. I think it might have a lair. If we follow the tracks, we might find it. Again, did you see how fast it was? It could take us days to find it, Will said, even if we do find it. Well, while it's alive, none of us are safe here, I said. We got enough water, but food will run out soon. We have to start thinking about some alternatives. Well, the creature probably needs water, right? Amber asked. There may be a creek nearby, and if there is, following it will get us out of the woods. We spent some time discussing it as a group, and in the end we came to the conclusion that we would make some torches, stock up on food, and follow its trail. We packed everything useful and made torches by cutting a few branches and wrapping them in cloth. We had no oil or fuel to make the flames last longer, so we figured we'd just need the torches to last us long enough to ward off the beast, should we come face to face with it. The thought of angering that thing filled me with an unspeakable fear, but also defiant satisfaction. One way or another, this all would be over soon. We inspected the place where Norton had been kidnapped, and it quickly became apparent that the tracks where he had been dragged on the ground were either clear of leaves or there was an obvious sign of leaves being flattened in places. If we wait too long and more leaves fall, we'll lose the trail. We need to go now, Will said as he picked up one leaf, inspecting it curiously. The rest of us agreed, and we let Will take the lead, since he seemed to have the best eye in figuring where to go whenever we lost the trail. Only a few hundred yards away, we saw two tracks merging into one, and it didn't take us long to figure that that one was from Norton and the other from the body the creature dragged off the night prior. It made it all the more easy for us, since the trail became a lot clearer. It also fortified Amber's theory that it had a lair, since the creature seemed to always move on the same path. We walked for about 30 minutes before we saw a blue piece of fabric on a nearby log. Will quickly bent down to inspect it. I think this is Norton's, he said. He was wearing blue pants. This is not good. Well, why not? Well, I think there's blood on it. He raised the fabric for everyone to see. Linda gasped, and Mitch inhaled through his teeth. Don't worry, it doesn't look like he was injured badly, but we better hurry, Will said. We went on for another hour before running into something completely unexpected off the trail, a big piece of metal. We looked past it and saw more tiny pieces scattered around. Look, Mitch pointed at a tiny clearing and then the rest of us saw it too. What was left of the pilot's cockpit was woefully sitting in the clearing, partially facing down with its nose. There might be something we could use here, I said. We approached the cockpit and immediately saw the body of one of the pilots. He was sitting in the chair in front of the cracked windshield, head slumped backwards. His abdomen was covered in blood, but we weren't sure whether the crash or something else killed him. Mitch saw an open first aid kit, and although some of the contents were used up, we took it just to be on the safe side. I glanced to the floor and saw a small device that looked like an MP3 player of sorts next to a flare gun. I knelt down and reached out to it, when a freezing hand grabbed my wrist. I looked up at the pilot, who previously had his eyes shut and now stared at me wide-eyed. You need to run, he spoke with a trembling voice. Get out of here before it comes back. I pulled back in horror, pulling the pilot off the chair along with me. He stumbled down like a rag doll and ceased moving altogether. Oh my God, Linda clasped her mouth with her hands. Mitch approached the pilot and checked his pulse. He's dead, he said, confused. I picked up the flare gun and device which were on the ground. The gun had a round in it, so I put it in my pocket and pressed the play button on the device. A voice started speaking through the device. This is Captain Miles. Our plane crashed less than an hour ago. My co-pilot and I are miraculously alive, but we don't know where the passengers are, since the plane broke into pieces. We still don't know what went wrong. We contacted control, but there was no response. We'll stay here and wait for rescue. We don't have much food or water left, so we'll make do with what we have. There was a pause before the voice started speaking again. This is Captain Miles. 10 hours have passed since the crash. We saw someone moving in the distance a while ago, but whoever it was, they ran away. If we're lucky, it's one of the locals, and we aren't far from civilization. Then there was another pause, and then... This is Captain Miles. It's been roughly a day since the crash. We keep seeing someone in the distance, always hiding behind the trees. Whenever we shout for the person and ask for help, they run away. My co-pilot thinks it's a bear, since he got a closer look. Just in case, we're keeping our flare gun close by and we'll continue having a campfire to stave off any potential predators. There was another short pause and then the captain's panting voice was heard. This time he was in a panic. Holy shit, this is Captain Miles. That was no fucking bear. I didn't manage to get a good look at it, but when I heard my co-pilot screaming, I turned around and saw him getting dragged away by this hairy fucking monster. I tried to follow them, but it was so damn fast and it's dark. I had to go back to the cockpit. I'm staying here until morning and then I'm getting the fuck out of here. Another pause, this time longer. I thought the recording was completely over, but then Miles continued. This is Captain Miles again. I tried running away, but this thing keeps toying with me. Wherever I go, it's there, just peeking behind the trees, pretending to hide. But I think it wanted me to see it. It knew what it was doing, because by noon I had taken so many reroutes that I was back at the plane and the creature was gone. I'll have to stay here and defend myself. There was another pause on the recording, and then he said again, It got me. It fucking got me. But I managed to wound it before it could finish me off. I shot off 2 flares and managed to take a few of its fingers with the first one. The second flare only scared it away. It seems to be afraid of unnatural lights and fire. This thing is really smart. It scouts during the day and attacks at night. Then there was a growl heard on the recorder. Linda cradled her arms, looking over her shoulder as if she expected the creature to appear right behind her. The pilot then continued, It's close now, watching me. I can see it just beyond the fire. It won't come near me as long as the fire is going, but I'm almost out of wood. I hope it can last until morning, but if it doesn't, I have 1 more flare remaining. I may not kill it, but I sure as hell will do a number on it before it takes me. If anyone finds this, don't wait for rescue. Try to kill the creature. Don't try running away because it follows. It knows this forest better than anything living in it. As for me, I'm not going to survive with my wounds either way. Captain Miles, out. The recording stopped. We all listened in silence and horror. Jesus Christ, Mitch said with a trembling voice. Well, that does it. We need to kill it, I said. Did you even hear what the pilot said, Mitch snapped. He fired a flare at it and it's still alive. 2 flares. Yeah, but we can't leave until it's dead. Don't you get it? This thing isn't going to let us leave the forest alive, so it's either us or it. I'm not going to fight that thing head first. All we have is this axe, and there's no way I'm going to win. Wait, Will raised his hand and interrupted Mitch. Where's Amber? We shot around and gave Linda, who was staring at the back, an accusatory look. She was just here a moment ago, she said. Amber, Amber, where are you? We all called out. And then we all saw it and it made our hearts sink to the floor. Blood. A trail of blood went along the clearing and into the tree line. Oh my God, we have to go get her, Linda said. Mitch took point and started following the trail, calling Amber's name along the way. It was evident that she lost a lot of blood, and in the best case scenario was badly wounded. The trail of blood started to thin out pretty soon, but since it merged with the tracks we followed prior to that, it wasn't very difficult to stay on the right path. How the fuck could you let this happen, Linda? Mitch shouted in frustration. What? Why are you blaming me for this? Linda defended herself. You were standing closest to her. Mitch, back off. It wasn't her fault, I rebutted. We all continued striding in silence. Guys, wait up, Will shouted from the back, barely able to keep up with Mitch, who was practically jogging now. Come on, we have to hurry. And then Mitch stopped dead in his tracks, making me bump into him. What the hell are you doing, Mitch? And then I realized why he stopped. In front of us was a cliff, and carved into it was a narrow passage into a cave. The passage itself was obscured by branches, so it could easily be missed, even walking next to it. The tracks of blood led inside and disappeared into the darkness of the cave. Well, this must be it. This must be where it lives, Mitch muttered and turned to the rest of us. Are you guys ready to do this? Nobody responded. Mitch whipped out his lighter and lit his own torch, and then he lit ours and went in without a moment hesitation. I remember watching him and his flame get consumed by the darkness, and I admired him, wondering if he was courageous or just a fucking moron. The rest of us followed suit, and what I expected would be a small cave turned out to be a complex combination of tunnel after tunnel. The passages were barely wide enough for even one of us to go through, so we went in a row, Mitch in front, then Will, then me and Linda. Oh, Jesus, Mitch stopped again and looked at a particular spot on the ground. What is it? I asked. He simply continued walking and said, come on, let's go. As I walked past what he was looking at on the ground, my torch illuminated enough for me to realize that what I was looking at was a human hand. A feminine, blood-curdling scream suddenly came from the cave, somewhere in the distance. Mitch shouted and then started running. I followed him and Will closely behind, clutching the torch in one hand and the flare gun in the other. The screams continued as if someone was being flayed alive, but it was impossible to tell which direction they were coming from. Mitch and Will rounded the corner and their flames disappeared out of sight, so I hurried after them, yelling at them to slow down and wait for me. The ground was uneven and slippery, and I could barely see in front of myself, and then another scream echoed. I turned around and realized that Linda was gone. Linda, are you there? I asked, but no response came through. Then, there was a low growl coming from the darkness in front of me, reverberating on the walls all around. I started running back in the direction of Mitch and Will, completely forgetting about the flare gun in my panic state. I couldn't see where my companion's torch flames were, and when I reached a fork in the passages, I panicked even further. With the inhuman scream following close behind me, I rushed to the left, now full on sprinting unsteadily. I kept losing balance due to the uneven ground, but I kept running for dear life, not caring where I was going. I just wanted to be as far away from that creature as possible. And then I felt the ground disappear from beneath my feet, and I stumbled forward, falling down somewhere and hitting my head. Everything went dark after that. I woke up with a throbbing headache. It was pitch black in front of me, and as I felt my way around the ground with my hands, I felt pebbles and rocks shifting and sliding. I no longer had my torch, however, the flare gun was still in my pocket. The screams that followed me previously were gone now, leaving me only with the sound of my own heavy panting. I didn't dare call out to my fellow survivors, under the fear of attracting something far worse. I still had my backpack on, so I reached into it and felt around until I found the lighter. I steadied myself on the pebbles that kept sliding around from underneath me and flicked it once. Immediately, the flame sparked to life. I gasped in terror at the sight I saw. Those weren't pebbles, but human bones. Hundreds, no thousands of them, on one big pile, covered in dry blood and dirt. I screamed and fell backwards. The light on my lighter disappeared instantly. I scooted back until my back hit the wall, hyperventilating. I flicked the lighter once more, and as soon as I was calmed down, I observed my surroundings. Bones were everywhere, and I saw no way out, but there had to be one. I stood up and unsteadily walked across the giant tomb, balancing myself on both legs in one hand, while holding the lighter with the other. The cave seemed to lead forward, so I followed the only remaining passage, hoping it wouldn't end with a dead end. There was a crack in the wall ahead, big enough for me to get through, and I heard the sound of water somewhere in the distance. With a rekindled hope, I followed the sound, cursing myself for allowing me to get into this situation. I wondered where Linda, Will, and Mitch were, but I was too preoccupied with claustrophobia and fear of being eaten alive to worry too much about them. And then I felt myself step into a puddle of water. I illuminated the ground and realized I was standing in a creek, which led to a tiny area contrasting the pitch darkness all around me. I hurried up, splashing my way through and breathing so loudly that my voice echoed throughout the cave. But then I remembered that I should probably be more quiet. The sound of water was getting louder, and when I finally reached the semi-illuminated part of the cave, I was in a more open area, with a crack on the ceiling, letting in a faint beam of moonlight. I thanked God for getting me out of the narrow tunnels, but my relief was short-lived when I heard a crunch echo from my left. I turned my head to the source of the sound slowly and saw movement in the distance. As my eyes adjusted, I saw a black figure hunched over, facing away from me. My heart started to race because I realized that there was no way that that sort of shape could belong to a human being. It was eating something, and I dreaded to think what its meal was. I immediately flicked my lighter off, and as I stood there, frozen in place, I looked around and realized that the only way out was in the direction of the creature. At first, I thought there's no fucking way I'd try to get past it, but then I remembered the only other way was to get back to the lair filled with bones. I mustered my courage, put the flare gun into my hand, and slowly began towards the opening where the creature was. With each crunch it made, my heart jumped just a little bit. As I got closer, the creature came into view a lot more clearly. Although it was hunched over and squatting, it was still pretty huge, almost as tall as I was. It had mangy black fur all over its body, the shape of it which was somewhat humanoid. Another loud crunch, followed by a chewing sound. The creature tossed a bone sideways in a bemused way, which fell down with a loud clank, and started chewing on something else. I was only a few feet away from it now, and slowly took steps sideways, not daring to look away. And then I saw what, or rather who, it was eating. Linda's eyes stared back at me blankly as the creature gnawed on what was left of her leg. I clasped my mouth with my hands to stop myself from screaming and continued sidestepping quietly. The creature then suddenly stopped chewing and shot its head up, sniffing the air. I stopped moving and held my breath, my heart just about ready to burst out of my chest. The creature continued sniffing more vigorously, now swiveling its head left and right. I could just barely make out a nose which resembled the snout, covered in the same fur as the rest of its body. The creature then stood frozen for a long moment, listening. I pointed the flare gun at it with trembling hands ready to pull the trigger. The creature looked back down and continued eating again, as if it didn't hear anything. I then lowered my gun and continued stepping away. I was able to put myself at a safe distance to speed up a little bit and sighed in relief when I turned the corner. I leaned down on my knees and steadied my breathing, with my heart still pounding in my chest. And then, I felt something grab my shoulder and just about jumped out of my skin. It was Mitch. He was holding his finger up to his mouth in a way to tell me to be quiet. I leaned in and whispered, "Where the fuck did you guys run off to? Where's Will?" "I don't know, I lost him," Mitch said. "We were attacked right before we found Amber, and..." "You found her?" Mitch shushed me and said, "Keep your voice down. Yeah, we found her. What was left of her, anyway. She was missing her foot and her arm. Poor girl was begging us to kill her." "Did you?" I asked. "Well, yeah, I had to. She couldn't move. She was in a lot of pain, and there was no way she'd survive it anyways. Will and I both agreed to do it. Listen, right now we have to find Will and Norton, if they're still alive." "No way. No way. We gotta get the fuck out of here," Mitch said. "That thing is invincible. Will managed to chase it away with a torch, but it's too damn fast, and it always comes back." "I'm not leaving them behind," I said. Mitch stared at me a while before saying, "Fine, let's look for them. Where's the flare gun you picked up?" "Right here." I raised it in my hand. "Keep it close." We went through the cave, and luckily Mitch had his flashlight, so it was a lot more convenient than going with a lighter. The cave was practically a maze, and after what felt like hours, we agreed that finding an exit should be our priority. We had just about given up hope, and we heard something that sounded like footsteps in the distance. Moreover, it sounded like boots or shoes, which rekindled our hope that it might be Will. I peeked around the corner and saw a person standing in the middle of the cave, pointing his flashlight around. "Will," I whispered. He turned around, his eyes wide in fear, until he recognized us and relief washed over his face. He smiled and we went out to meet him. "Thank goodness you're alive," Will said. "I've been trying to find you." And then Will's sentence was cut off when a big black figure ran past right in front of our noses and took Will along with it. Will screamed as the creature held his neck with its teeth and rapidly jerked him left and right. Mitch ran up to the creature and swung his axe hard, embedding it into the creature's back. The creature then let go of Will's neck, which was now at an unnatural angle, and he screamed in pain. The entire cave then echoed, and my ears started to hurt. Before Mitch could pull the axe back out, the creature turned around, grabbing at its back, unable to reach it. It then turned its attention to Mitch, and with movement faster than the blink of an eye, swiped its claws across the air. I didn't even realize what happened until I saw Mitch bleeding from his throat and grabbing at his neck. The creature then screamed again, revealing a row of razor-sharp teeth. It tackled Mitch and sank its teeth into his neck, biting off a chunk of it and a few of his fingers in the process. All of this happened so fast that I barely had time to react, plus the whole thing put me in a trance. And then the creature looked up at me with glowing eyes, snarling, blood dripping from its chin. I only had one shot. I pointed the flare gun at the creature and I fired. The entire area was immediately illuminated with a bright red color, and the creature screamed even louder, grabbing at its eyes, which had now lost its glow, flailing its arms furiously. I glanced down at the bodies of my fellow passengers. Both of them, I could see, were dead. I turned on my heel and bolted out of there, the screams of that creature following me all the way through the cave. I ran for what felt like hours, tired, but I never stopped. The thought of meeting my demise like the rest of them filled me with an inexplicable fear. After a while, I finally saw moonlight peeking from a crack in the distance and hurried up to it. I felt a cold breeze as I got closer and squeezed my way through, breathing in fresh air and listening to the soothing sounds of the forest life around me. The scream of the creature echoed from inside the cave once more, this time sounding like a cry of pure anger, and although it was distant, I knew it could change at any moment. I stumbled through the woods, always looking over my shoulder and expecting to see the creature either behind or suddenly appearing in front of me. Daylight came soon enough, and I fell to the ground, exhausted, hungry, and thirsty. Eventually, my adrenaline subsided, and I started to feel guilty and ashamed for allowing the other passengers to die like that. I broke down, rocking back and forth and letting my guilt gnaw at me like that for a while, and then I heard something in the distance. I couldn't tell what they were saying, but when I looked up, I saw a group of people walking around. I called out to them, and they immediately approached me, realizing I was in distress. I tried explaining to them that there was a dangerous predator nearby, but they didn't seem to understand what I was saying. They spoke to me, but I didn't understand their language. I figured they were locals and cried again in happiness when I realized I was safe. And that's how I was brought back to civilization. I told the rescue services that going back to the crash site is dangerous, but they ignored me. They dismissed my stories as exaggeration due to trauma and continued their search for the passengers. Not even 2 days later, the case was closed and a statement made that there were no survivors. Norton's body was never found, but then again, they never found the cave I mentioned either. Ever since, I've been plagued by survivor's guilt, nightmares, and PTSD. I wake up, thinking I feel a presence in my room, quietly watching me and waiting for the moment when I let my guard down. I won't go camping and have never used airplanes again, except once, 2 days ago. I'm in a small town right now, close to the crash site. The locals here are friendly, but when I ask them about the creature, they suddenly go silent or find an excuse to leave. Others swear the creature I'm describing is peaceful and that running into it poses no threat. And others in the town denies the creature's existence altogether, calling me crazy. But despite everyone's opinions, all the locals feel one way about it. No one should go to the area of the sightings of it. I don't know what to think that thing is, and frankly, I don't care. I brought guns with me, and tomorrow I'm going back to the crash site. One way or another, I'm killing that thing.